the church in Ephesus, which was in danger of losing the love that it had at first for Christ in the midst of their busy lives. And this week, we are looking at the church in Smyrna, which I'm sure you are all intimately familiar with. You could pick it out on a map, right? Easily. Although right now, it's actually where the city of Izmir is, and you all know where that is, too. So that helps. So Smyrna was very similar to Ephesus in that it was a great port city in what today we call the country of Turkey. It was often called the most beautiful of the Asian cities in the Roman Empire. It had distinct and noteworthy architecture. It had renowned schools of science and medicine. It was the birthplace of the great poet Homer, or at least if you asked them, because they were on a long list of places that claimed to be the birthplace of the poet Homer. But they were at least smart enough to build a very large, beautiful building to reinforce their claim to that. They had a 20,000-person amphitheater, which was pretty large in those days. But of particular note for the Christians at that time, Smyrna built a giant, glorious temple to the Roman Emperor Tiberius and his mother Julia. Now, to help you wrap your mind around why that would be such a big deal for the Christians, let's teleport ourselves and our minds to New York City and go to a street on the water, one with a nice view of Liberty Island. Now, what's on Liberty Island? You're right, that ugly, green, unfashionably dressed woman with spikes coming out of her head who looks like she's at a rock concert holding a flame above her head. Would that go over very well if that's how you described the Statue of Liberty to some New Yorkers selling the little miniatures on the street? I don't think that would go well. Or how about, you know, when Christians said that the Temple of Tiberius, which was one of the most known things in Smyrna, when they said that that was idolatry, when that was invalid, when they said that that temple worshiping the emperor is an offense to God, it was kind of like insulting the Statue of Liberty, something key to the identity of the city. And they also didn't like, there was a nice temple to Zeus in Smyrna as well. They didn't like that either. So start offending the Empire State Building while you're at it just to get the full experience. Or what if you know someone who came to Denver to visit and they looked out at the mountains and said, eh, those aren't that nice. And then they came with you to church and they looked around and they saw the stencils and the stained glass windows and the old charm that we have here and they started saying how old and stuffy it is. Would you appreciate that? Probably not, right? Are you tracking with me now? The Christians in Smyrna were swimming upstream. Their beliefs made them downright offensive to many of the people in their city, and that left them very vulnerable. Revelation chapter 2. And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, these are the words of the first and the last who was dead and came to life. I know your affliction. I know your poverty, even though you are rich. I know the slander on the part of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Beware. The devil is about to throw some of you into prison so that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have affliction. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. Let anyone who has an ear listen to what the Spirit is saying to the churches. Whoever conquers will not be harmed by the second death. This is the word of the Lord, so thanks be to God. Well, my brother and I had an unwritten rule: no punching in the face. Pretty much everything else was a valid target, except for one area you can probably guess was also off limits. But one day, I was absolutely fed up with my brother because I had to do chores this afternoon and he didn't. The indignity, the injustice of that. And to heap even more burning coals upon me, my brother decided to fill his free time while I was mopping by filling water balloons and throwing them at a certain younger brother. And in case you're wondering, no, I don't think he was trying to make sure I had enough water for my mopping task. And so as the pops and splashes started piling up, the rage within me started building, and finally I snapped. And with a war cry to rival the Texans at the Alamo, I charged my brother with my dripping implement of destruction, and he thought this was actually kind of funny. He was laughing at this scene of me charging him right up until the point when I went like this. And then his eyes started getting wider and wider. Now, to be fair, the rule was no punching in the face. There was no clause about mops. And so with full intent of wiping that smile from his face, but right here I realized this may not be the best idea. And so I pulled back and it swooshed about a millimeter away from his face. He and I stared at each other for a second that stretched into eternity. You know, I think there was a tumbleweed going by in the background. And then he punched me in the gut with his fist and ran away, hoping not to get hit by the mop. Have you ever been punched in the gut when you weren't expecting it? I mean, I literally couldn't breathe. I was stumbling around trying to choke in some air. I was completely incapacitated. The church in Smyrna has been the recipient of a bunch of gut punches over the years. John writes in our text today, "Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Beware, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison so that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have affliction." These words were written to the whole church, but especially to the leader Polycarp. He had been personally discipled by John. He most definitely did not die of natural causes. At the age of 86, the Romans sentenced him to be burned at the stake for refusing to worship the emperor as a god. That was a gut punch to the church in Smyrna, and a wee bit more than a gut punch for Polycarp. Later on, Christians were doing a lot better in the Roman Empire. They had, you know, official status, but they still got a gut punch from their fellow Christians at that point. Because at that time, the Eastern churches celebrated Passover instead of Easter as we know it. And they still were celebrating the same thing, but they were doing it on Passover. But the Pope in Rome decided to flex his newfound muscles and told them that they had to stop celebrating Passover. They had to celebrate Easter on the Sunday that we do it now. And to make sure it happened, he removed the bishop of Smyrna and put in someone friendly to Rome. Can you imagine if, like, Presbyterian headquarters back in Louisville, I bet you didn't even know it was in Louisville, told us, you know, you can't celebrate Christmas Eve anymore. No services on Christmas Eve. You have to do the Sunday that is closest to December 25th instead. That is a mandate, and if you refuse, we will remove your pastor. Would that go over very, would you appreciate that heavy-handedness? I don't think that would be appreciated. That was a gut punch to be muscled around by their fellow Christians. But the biggest gut punch by far came around the end of World War I. For a number of years around the end of the war, when the Ottoman Empire started becoming the country of Turkey as we know it today, they carried out a series of genocides against Christians all across the country. Christians before that were about 20% of the population of Turkey. After that, they had the lowest Christian population of any country in that area. 3 million Christians were systematically killed during that time. That is far more than a gut punch. And that's what the church in Smyrna has endured. That's the suffering, that's the affliction that is predicted in Revelation that they have suffered over and over again. Have you ever been punched in the gut? Ever had your life stopped in its tracks? Ever suffered like Smyrna? I think as we look at this, there are at least a couple of ways to look at this kind of suffering. One way is righteous indignation, anger at God for allowing this. I mean, he's telling the church, which he calls the bride of Christ, the bride of his son, that you're gonna have affliction for 10 days. And this is not literally 10 days. We could probably handle 10 days. This is figurative, meaning a long time, but not forever. And then God says he's not going to stop it. What's up with that? Why doesn't God prevent the suffering of this faithful church? Why doesn't God avert the gut punch? Why would a supposedly loving, supposedly all-powerful God sit on his hands while all of this stuff goes down? Surely, God must not exist. Surely, God must not be loving if he does exist. And surely, if he does exist and is loving, God cannot be all-powerful. Those are our options, right? What other explanation could there be for such suffering? That's one way to look at the suffering of Smyrna and our own suffering as well. But on the other hand, what does Jesus say to the church? He says, "Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. Whoever conquers will not be harmed by the second death. Now, basically, Jesus is telling them that their suffering doesn't change who Jesus is, and it doesn't change who they are either. The fact that Jesus came down to heal our relationship with God is not changed by our suffering. The fact that Jesus rose again from the dead to claim power over death, that's still there. Suffering doesn't change that. And the promise we have of being united with God, suffering doesn't change that promise either. In case you're wondering, what does this second death part mean? That's referring to the final judgment. And if you want to know more about that, keep reading in the book of Revelation. And after some dragons and stuff, you'll eventually get there. And I encourage you to do that. Stick with it. But simply put, Jesus is saying that when you have faith, even through the gut punch of suffering, it shows that your eternal destination is secure. That's what he's basically saying there. And so on one hand, you could see this gut punch of suffering as clear evidence that God is not who you thought he was. But on the other hand, you could see faith in the midst of suffering as clear evidence that God is exactly who he says he is. There's a song on Christian radio called Oh My Soul, written by Mark Hall of Casting Crowns. And he wrote this song toward the tail end of a big battle that he had with cancer personally. And he said that in the midst of the pain, in the midst of the uncertainty, his emotions were running away from him. And he would yell at God. He would curse at God, doubt God's love for him, doubt God's existence, stoke the fires of fury within him. But each time his emotions would start to run away with him like that, they would come up against some resistance inside of himself. They smashed up against the wall of faith that he had built over his entire life. And at that time, he was reminded of Psalm 42, verse 11, where David is feeling downcast, and he has to give himself a little pep talk. And he says, "Why so downcast, O my soul? Put your hope in God." That is like the proverbial unstoppable force of your emotions coming against the immovable object of your faith. One of them has to give. Have you ever experienced your emotions crashing against your faith like a storm surge trying to overtop a levee? I know exactly what Mark Hall is talking about. We just spent a week with a bunch of families who are dealing with that on a daily basis. We were up at Adams Camp, is up near Granby, just a couple of hours away. But families from all over the country come to this camp. It's a week-long intensive therapy camp for kids with special needs, developmental delays, debilitating illnesses. And so the founder shared her story. She was so excited. She had a long, difficult battle with infertility. And then they got the news that she was pregnant, and then got the even more exciting news that it was triplets. And they were so young and naive, they didn't understand the looks of horror on their parents' faces of that many babies at once. And so they were, you know, dreaming about what this would look like. But the dream started to turn to a nightmare as they came incredibly early. And all three of her two-pound baby boys had to fight for their lives. After 10 days, they had to make the gut-wrenching decision to pull life support from one of them. The other one came out pretty much okay. And then the third, Adam, from Adam's camp, had significant brain bleeding and cerebral palsy, will have difficulties for his whole life. That's a gut punch. In our group, we had different groups. In my son Charlie's group, there was a family who adopted a kid, and they knew that he had special needs, had some developmental delays from overseas. They adopted him, but they knew what they were getting into. They thought through their faith that they could handle this. Until one day, he choked and had a massive loss of oxygen to the brain and went on a downward spiral. His already dim prospects took a nosedive after that. That's a gut punch. Another family in our group had to essentially spend a couple of years apart from each other, living in different states, because their home state didn't have the help, didn't have the medical services, didn't have the doctors that they needed. They were essentially medical refugees within the United States. That's a gut punch. And so looking around the room at Adam's camp, maybe you could wonder if there's a God. Maybe you could wonder if God is really loving. Maybe you could wonder if God is really able to do anything, because it's a room full of suffering children and their strung out families. But, you know, then the founder continued her story of why she started this camp, why it continued for 30 years. Because of that first camp 30 years ago, they had been told that their son Adam would probably be confined to a wheelchair the rest of his life. But by the end of that first Adam's camp, as he was had intensive therapy, as he was inspired by other kids watching them walk around, he took his first steps, unassisted, and never looked back. And that inspired her to continue this camp and expand it for others. So maybe, as you look around that room at Adam's camp, maybe instead of wondering if there's a God who's loving and capable of doing things, maybe instead of just seeing all of the undeniable suffering in that room, maybe you also see the miracles. Maybe you see the moments of impossible grace that changed those kids' lives forever. Maybe you see therapists from all over the country coming in. Some of them drove themselves from Alabama to be a part of this camp because they wanted to be a part of it. Maybe you see families getting a break for the first time in years. And maybe you see humanity's incredible capacity for good because this camp exists. Both of those viewpoints are available in the midst of suffering. You could have fist-shaking anger or eye-watering grace. That's that unstoppable force of emotion versus the immovable object of faith. And that's a battle that can go either direction, depending on the person. There is no guarantee that your personal faith will survive suffering. That's why Jesus says, whoever conquers, because that battle can go either way. Now, to illustrate this choice, I'm going to take out the photo that we have in the insert in your bulletin. It's a little loose leaf. Got permission to use this. The little girl on the left, make sure you all got it. So the little girl on the left was in my son Charlie's group at Adam's camp, and the boy she's pushing in the little walker was another Adam's camper. And if you look in the background, you see all those people with light blue shirts on. They're all Adam's campers as well. And this was at a free concert the city of Winter Park set up, and they set up a special section for all the Adam's campers to come. And so on one hand, you could look at this photo, and you could see how many blue shirts there are, and you could shake your fist at God. Maybe you see this boy who needs a walker, and you question God's existence. Or this little girl has a rare genetic disorder that results in developmental delays, difficulty walking, a host of lifelong issues. Maybe you see her and you wonder if a loving God would let that happen. I mean, a genetic disorder, that's DNA. That's God's purview, right? That's the design. That should be God's fault. There are undeniable suffering represented in this photo. But there are a few other things to see as well. That wonderful little girl has trouble walking. She couldn't even walk on her own until very recently. And yet here she is with a big grin on her face, pushing around a little boy in his walker. She is experiencing joy doing something that her suffering makes incredibly difficult for her to do. I see that as grace. You can't see it in the photo, but just off to the left of the frame, just outside the frame, is the father of this boy that's being pushed around. And they were really hoping, their goal was for their son to be able to interact with and socialize with other kids. Here's his chance. I see that as grace. The kids in blue in the background. Yeah, they've all got developmental delays. Most of them will have lifelong problems, but here they are dancing with all their might to the bluegrassy tunes from this band from Wisconsin. The Bible says that David danced before the Lord with all of his might, but David ain't got nothing on the Adam's campers. Charlie included. Sorry. I sent a video to my mom of Charlie dancing, and she said if she was going to name his moves, it would be the joyful. That is grace. Suffering and grace. Pain and miracle. It's all in that photo. But if you spend your time focusing just on the suffering, you'll be blind to the grace. You'll be blind to the miracles all around you. Because suffering does not change who God is. Suffering is still suffering. I'm not going to minimize what we've experienced, not going to minimize what anyone in that photo has experienced, not going to minimize what anyone here has experienced. You know, I used to wish privately that Jesus, you know, would hold off coming back until I could, like, live my life and experience things. And now I'll take it 15 minutes from now. That'd be great. Just long enough for me to get the food at the table after worship. Then we're good. I'll take every tear wiped away from our eyes. I'll take resurrected bodies that don't have to contend with seizures or with cancer or with disorders. Bring it on. But in the meantime, there are glimpses of heaven all around us, if we have eyes to see and ears to hear. It doesn't take away the suffering. Smyrna still suffered gut punch after gut punch. But those glimpses might be enough to sustain us where we would otherwise crumble. The fact that those parents at Adams Camp are still standing is a miracle in and of itself. The fact that such a camp exists is a miracle. And those moments of joy in the midst of suffering, just like we see in that photo, those are miracles. Suffering doesn't change what Jesus did for you. Suffering doesn't get rid of the Holy Spirit's presence. So see the grace. See the miracle. As Jesus said to this suffering Smyrna, "Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life." Or as David had to remind himself, "Why so downcast, O my soul? Put your hope in God, even if that's just a glimmer in the darkness." Amen.